You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Sarah and Everardo. They're going to tell us a little bit about what they're working on, and we're talking to them from Long Island City. Sarah and Everardo, both, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us.
So to begin with, and either one of you can begin to field this question, can you tell us the nature of your collaboration and relationship and what it's evolved into?
So Everardo asked me to go first. So we're partners in work and in life. And the partnership that you're probably most interested in is our architectural partnership. When we started our office, we said we'd do 50% of our work for the community, for communities underserved by the design profession, which is a commitment that we've kept. We said that we'd be research intensive, and that means different things for different projects. So we don't have clear roles that are different from each other. We have a method of working back and forth and having two very different points of view, which usually we can work out without too much conflict, but sometimes a little conflict enters. And if we find that we're sort of talking past each other and really not agreeing, it usually means that we have to come up with another idea that incorporates the concerns of the ideas that aren't compatible. It often leads to the most interesting concepts and designs in our work, I think, when we do have those moments of conflict.
But there is a role for our staff, and typically
when
ideas are unspecific and not precise, we ask the staff to come up with ideas and come up with design ideas in model forms or drawings, and then we discuss that as a team, and from there we get new ideas.
So let's talk about that collaborative process a little bit. And I mean, Sarah, you were saying that there's also I am most interested in your architectural collaborative and your company, but is there other ways you collaborate that I'm not aware of?
Well, because we're life partners, we collaborate teaching, we collaborate being parents, we collaborate doing pro bono work sometimes for nonprofits. So we do a number of collaborations which aren't directly part of our firm's work. Some of them personal, real-life stuff or non-professional life stuff, and some of them kind of related.
Well, children are certainly a powerful collaboration. I'm working on one myself. how old are your children?
My son is 26.
Is he reminded of the other
day? And he's applying for graduate.
So tell us a little bit about how you both began the practice. What were with the intention that you went into, which was to do 50% of reaching communities that may not have had that. How did you begin your practice and begin engaging those kind of ideas, which are wonderful?
So I think we're more design people than business people. So some of the process was kind of random at the beginning. We found nonprofits that needed help. The first project that we did was a preschool for children with full-blown AIDS in the Bronx. We've done schools for developmentally delayed children, for autistic spectrum children. We've done community centers in all kinds of neighborhoods that weren't so well served. We've done, increasingly, it's more community institutions. We did a civic theater for Queens, and we recently finished a museum on an African American heritage site in Brooklyn.
We hope to bring a certain type of architectural value or give these institutions the benefits of the beauty of architecture and to really codify their intentions. So for kids with AIDS, we have to be careful about how the management of kids through the classrooms and how the classrooms were designed, and to create an environment that was peaceful and quiet for them because their lives are so intense with other issues.
I love that. I was going to ask specifically what you designed for them. And for the next school, where you were talking about kids who are, learning disabled or whatever the term is, challenged in other areas, how are those approached? And that would seem to be something that architects may typically not think of, I would imagine. The research was interesting there, especially as parents. So how did you approach, and maybe you can pick one of the other schools you did, as that was the beginning of your practice and you were employing some of the ideas that you're discussing, Everardo?
Developmentally delayed is what used to be called retarded, and the Asperger's autism spectrum, I think people are more familiar with now because it's become such a thing. With all of these schools, we found that one of the places that we started was by going deeper into discussing the actual pedagogy, the teaching theories, and the educational theories that the schools were interested in working with and committed to, and learning more about the theory and the philosophy behind those practices of teaching, and then starting to work outward again from that in designing the spaces. So that first preschool that we were telling you about, Everardo and I had both come from design-intensive firms, and we thought at the beginning of this endeavor, we thought we were bringing skills to this endeavor, but we didn't understand how much we needed to learn from the communities and clients that we were working with. And so we started to design these classrooms, to design every corner and also to design the public areas. And as we started to look into the pedagogy, and as we started to work with the educators and the families, we discovered that we were kind of on the wrong track in terms of design, and that the whole theory of teaching was to empower the teacher and to give the teacher more agency over rearranging and designing the rooms. And so what we needed to do was to create a space that the teacher could manipulate and to just provide certain things and make them easy for the teacher to change. But then there were these public spaces, these shared spaces where nobody really was in charge of the space. And there, it was much more important for us to bring ideas of color and detail and customization to every corner, because in those spaces that were shared, where there wasn't a specific ownership, it was important to up the kind of quality of imagination and spatial change. So it started, that was the first thing where our way we approached design started to change.
And the other issue for us was natural light. And that was our domain. We tried to maximize natural light in the classrooms, if we could, in the other circulation areas. So, and how we could borrow from the windows to get more light into the corridors. So we used natural light as the as the catalyst or the for us, the most important element in every school.
Mm-hmm. In almost every project, in one way or another, the way that as the control and the bringing in of natural light brings, we've found that it's a quality that some of our clients regard as almost spiritual and is a source of satisfaction and joyfulness in almost every place that we've created. So that is something that we work with in a lot of different ways to try and create a place that responds to people's soul needs.
We just completed a project in an area of Brooklyn called Graves End. It's a dreary part of Brooklyn. And it's located there, a new pre-K school for kids. And it was a manufacturing plant.
Oh, right. So it's in a former manufacturing area. It's an old manufacturing building that then was turned into a Social Security office. And now it's being changed into a preschool as part of the mayor's initiative to create preschool for all children in the city of New York.
But it gave us the opportunity to use skylights in a very interesting way to create spaces that are, we hope, magical and memorable for the kids to come into every day. And we were fortunate to have a little courtyard that we made into a garden, and we call it the Secret Gardens for the Kids. So the circulation is through this little courtyard into the space that's just with skylights located, large ones, small ones, to mark the circulation and also to enliven the classrooms.
I love that. You know, it makes me think all the schools that I went to as a kid looked more like jails. You know, there was no natural light almost, and no really magical spaces at all. And I think the way you're both talking about giving teachers a kind of agency to rearrange and change the classroom is very powerful and a kind of wonderful way of looking at it. So let's talk a little bit more about this recent project. Did that also incorporate, besides the natural light, and that it sounds like a very beautiful little garden space, were teachers also given a kind of ability to change the spaces or work with the spaces there as well?
So it's very interesting. It's part of the New York City public school system, and the School Construction Authority has very specific guidelines. Their effort is for each classroom, they try to create equity so that the preschool in Gravesend has the exact same kit for the teacher as the preschool in the Upper East Side. So there's really an idea of equity. But even within these guidelines and these restrictions, it turns out that you can increase the agency by looking at the ways that natural light is brought in and that the teacher can control it, and by looking at subtle things to the standard configurations that you can massage them just a little bit to increase that agency. So that's the kind of thing that we looked at very carefully. And then, again, these shared spaces, these kind of no man's land that could just be these dull transitions or could be spaces that offer activity and a place to gather and a memory of their own. Again, those spaces are spaces that we took very seriously and created a series of them to create a series of experiences for the children and the teachers and their children's families that would help anchor this school in the idea of learning being an exciting, constructive act.
But the wonderful thing about our tradition is that we can work with light and create proportions and spaces that can become magical just by reflected light. in this particular case, the ceiling height was quite low, say about 9 feet, and we had these very sharp skylights, and the rooms would feel like teepees, so that the kids would have this kind of skylight, this low room with a very nice skylight in it. So it's not a tall room, it's a shallow room. But the feeling it, the emotional feeling of the light coming in from above, is something that we were trying to make happen. And the proportions of the skylights as you move down the corridor, the spacing of them, and the borrowed light of them, we hope would make the space really kind of a memory place for little kids.
Right. So some of the things that we find that are sort of, I'm sure in talking with artists who work with light, they've described some of the same things. Since light is coming from the sun, and since it changes over the seasons, but that it's also very predictable where it's coming from and what angle at any moment of the year, we look not only at the opening, but we look at the reflected light. We map that out, and we find out sometimes that makes us create these kind of collars that increase the reflected light. It makes us do very specific things in response to the specific light that comes into that space that makes it more interesting spatially and it creates a specific quality of light and sometimes we let that quality change with the time of day and the seasons, and sometimes we make it more diffuse depending on the space and the feeling that we're trying to create. And sometimes we allow people to look directly at the light source and see the sky, and sometimes we conceal where the light is coming from and just have the emphasis on the light itself. So the incredible range of ways that you can respond to light architecturally and use it to create a different experience in the space, the more that we work with it, the more the range of it is just astonishing.
And another element is the color of the wall. So Sarah selects an orange or a very light white, and the reflections of light on the wall create another dimension to these classrooms and spaces.
Mm-hmm. Right. So sometimes you're just trying to have a sense of the light, and sometimes the light itself, depending on the material we use, you can see the light itself create a path if we're looking through translucent materials, for instance. And sometimes we want to use the daylight to reflect colors and to intensify a certain color range. So the different ways that you can encounter light are just amazing.
It sounds gorgeous, and that's become a signature aspect of your practice, isn't it?
That's right, and I should say not only light, but the shadows, that the actual use of shadows, you know, because people notice that light moves usually by looking at shadows, not by looking at the light itself. And so increasingly, for instance, at Weeksfield, at the museum we did for this African American Heritage Site in Brooklyn, we have certain patterns in skylights which people notice that they move, you know, from when they come to the place to when they leave the place. They notice the patterns on the floor, not in the sky above, but then one of the things that we do in sustainable architecture is that very often we have series of dots printed on the glass to reduce the sunlight. So instead of dots, we had custom patterns created based on Congolese fabrics and on patterns that appeared that kind of appeared and disappeared and reappeared in African American art. And on a gray day, you don't really notice these patterns, but on a sunny day, you see the patterns, again, you see their shadows on the framing of the skylights. So shadows have become a part of how we play with light.
It's become another dimension for us to explore.
Right. So they, a lot of it is looking at the different phenomenological possibilities of architecture and trying to use those to help amplify people's experience of place.
And now we're trying to work more with shiny surfaces or just touches of shiny surfaces to get
mm-hmm.
reflectivity and use the light to kind of emphasize textures, perhaps. So that's our new, we're trying to use that in simple little projects.
I would think designing an artist studio would also be something that would be, you know, the more I think about the way you're talking about light, of course, artists are always thinking about light in their studios,
right.
And but it's never quite what anybody wants it to be because you don't normally get to design it. But it would seem that designing an artist studio would be something that you'd both be suited for as well.
Oh, that would be a wonderful thing. We haven't gotten to do that yet, but one of the things we're working on now, which is it's a musical artist, not a visual or three-dimensional artist. We're working on a museum for about Louis Armstrong. And so beside some of the acoustical explorations that we're doing, what Everardo was talking about just a moment ago, using reflected light and light off shiny things, bouncing off shiny things, as well as kind of matte surfaces. We've been exploring that quite a bit in the design of this museum about Louis Armstrong.
And when will that museum open, and where will that museum be?
It will be across the street from his house, which has already been turned into a museum in Corona, Queens, which is a section of Queens, one of the boroughs of New York. And best prediction is 2017, 2018, it should open, about 3 years from now.
Well, Sarah and Everardo, both of those projects that you've been discussing, and all of them are very exciting, and I really love the way you both talk to me about this work, and especially with light. I think that's fascinating to a lot of artists. Before we close this interview, is there any other places you want to guide people to, whether they're in New York or around the world, to see your work, if possible, or anything in that regard?
Well, we would love if they went to see Weeksville in Brooklyn.
Right, so Weeksville Heritage Center, that would be wonderful. There's a four historic houses from the original African American community of freedmen, and the new building and interpretive campus. So we recommend that to anybody. And the other thing that we invite people to visit is the Queens Theater in Flushing Meadows Park. It's the Municipal Theater for Queens, and it's the first modern extension to the old New York World's Fair site by Philip Johnson. So there's a lot of yin and yang going on there.
Sarah and Everardo, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really enjoyed hearing about your work and practices.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you.
We're big fans of your podcast, so we're thrilled to be part of that.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.